Are you guys? Okay.
Everything's good.
Start again.
All right. Yeah, we're going to resume the board meeting of the Utah Geological Survey at 10:20. And I'd like to introduce Mike Vandenberg, who's going to tell us about Newfield's proposal for research on the Olympus.
Could I just jump why I thought it was important for this to be in front of the board? Again, because we've been looking at powers and duties, is although this is with the university, so officially we're just subcontracting the university, so it's like a normal proposal, but in effect it is, the funding is coming from the private entity. There's a condition in here under powers and duties, which in effect, here we go, says, survey may undertake joint projects with private entities if the action is approved by the board, projects are not inconsistent with the state's objectives, and the results of the projects are available to the public. So whether it comes under that, because we're just subcontracting the university, or whether officially it's with a private entity, I thought the safest thing is for Mike just to review for you. You approved it by email. But you're aware of it, and we can be minuted that you're aware of it and approve of it. Just be on the safe side. Go for it, Mike.
Okay, so a little bit of background. DOE came out with a solicitation back in late June, looking at, again, unconventional oil and gas potential in various basins in the United States. We always take a pretty keen interest in these DOE solicitations because it could mean a lot of money to the UTS. So we started to brainstorm and think about, okay, what can we do here? And I talked to Don McClendon up at UTI. We partnered with them several times in the past. And we kind of thought about the extension of the project that I'm actually finishing up right now that we did on the Uteland Butte and the King Creek. But looking at Wasatch Flagstaff play, so below the Green River Formation in the Uinta Basin. Some companies, in particular Newfield, have been drilling horizontals in the Wasatch. They call it the Wasatch, we call it the Flagstaff. But it's still lacustrine, high organic lacustrine carbonates.
Got pretty good wells.
Yeah, they've been having very good success. They've drilled about 20 horizontals so far. Some of them are even better than the Green River Formation horizontals. However, it's pretty new. Like I said, only 20 wells. It's emerging. We think there's a lot of potential outside of the core Newfield area. And so the idea was to do the geologic characterization, the reservoir characterization, and then also have John McClendon up at the U do with the geomechanics side. So we started putting this together, and of course we always like to get company participation, so I immediately called Newfield, and they liked the idea. However, unlike the Uteland Butte project that we did, I applied for that, it's almost 5 years ago now, 4 years ago. That project, we had five or six companies on board, because there were five or six companies drilling wells in the Uteland Butte. So they were all supplying data, supplying core, supplying support. And when you have that many companies involved, it's easier to get more companies involved because everybody's sharing data. Everybody is showing some proprietary data because then they get access to other people's proprietary data. This was a little different in that the only company drilling horizontals and the only company that had good core is Newfield. Not really any other companies. So of course they started to question, well, if we partner with you on this project, that means some of our core data and some of our information is going to be made public, and it will benefit basically all the companies around them, and the companies around them wouldn't have given anything of their own to this project. And so when we were on a conference call with Newfield, it kind of just struck me. I was like, well, maybe Newfield would be willing to just fund this project independently of DOE. So we asked them that, and they actually really liked that idea. Now, the DOE projects, to write one of those proposals is extremely onerous. I've written two of them so far, and they take about a month of full-time work just to write the proposal. And the solicitation was mainly, you could tell it was written for the big basins, like the Permian and the Anadarko Basin. So this, our little project in the Uinta Basin would have been a pretty long shot, just a huge long shot, but we thought, well, we'll do it anyways. When Newfield expressed interest in funding this project independently, we got all excited because that meant probably didn't have to go write this huge DOE proposal. We could just do something much more simple for Newfield, and the probability of getting funding from Newfield was much higher than we thought getting the funding from DOE. So we kind of abandoned the DOE side and just focused on working with Newfield. So we wrote up this proposal. I have a few copies here if anybody's interested. So it's essentially about, it's half and half UGS and EGI. The idea would be that Newfield would contract with EGI, then we'd be a subcontract with EGI. I've done this in the past with the geology department up the U. We get funding from Total, a French oil company, where Total contracted with the geology department, and then we were a subcontract. And this kind of creates, we're one step removed from the private funding that way. So the idea is just a two-year project. UGS would get about $160,000 from Newfield, and we would throw in the 20% cost share. That's why it went around to four. So the cost share would be about $32,000.
And the results would all be open to everyone?
Yes. So that will be one of the stipulations, that eventually all the data would be in the public domain. And the same would go for EGI, because they plan on having a grad student involved. So this data would need to be publishable, but what Newfield liked about this idea was that they would have more control over actually what gets published, and then, more importantly, the time of when it would get published. So we could wait until the end of the project 2 years from now to publish anything, and they would be happy with that. Whereas with the DOE solicitation, the big part of the solicitation was having either a well itself or core material available to the wider public. And they really didn't like that idea, having their core material available to the wider public, whatever that means. This way, we have much more control over how the data is released and who has access to it. So, that's the idea. It's working up its way to the CEO of Newfield. The last time I talked to them was maybe a week ago, and it's just still working up the chain, so I don't want to bug them too much. We're not in a huge hurry at the moment. The lower, the VPs were favorable of the project. So we'll see.
So in the interim before it's published, then Newfield can use that information that they have. So they do have an advantage.
Well, they're a member or an associate of EGI.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, that's part of what EGI does for its members.
EGI is supplying a significant cost share and supplying all the geomechanical testing for free if Newfield re-ups their annual subscription to their company consortium.
So, Mark, I wonder, you were saying we should ratify some of the decisions, whether it's worthwhile now, just the board saying they're comfortable with it, and if it proceeds,
sure.
they're happy to. Just because the result is
see, we do we have a list of the
no.
proposals
well,
that we've done since?
This one
oh, just this one?
Yeah.
Okay.
The private sector
yeah.
funding, even though it's down the chain. But
somebody like to make a motion that we ratify the approval of the Newfield project that we gave electronically in the last week or so?
I'll make a motion that we ratify the Newfield proposal.
Thank you. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
All those in favor? Oh, is there a discussion?
Anything needs to be clarified? Or?
Apparently not. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? It's unanimous. Thank you.
So, yeah. Thanks, Mike.
Sure.
Let's,
yeah, thank you very much, Mike.
Oh, they said that'd be cool.
Jim's there.
Jim's there.
I'm here.
I'll run down and make copies of these really quick.
What's that? Yeah,
sure.
Grant was here.
Oh.
They said we'd call him. So, can you
go get Grant?
Grant?
Yeah. All right. I brought in the latest of Utah dinosaurs.
Oh, good. So, this is Jim Kirkland, who's after Grant does the introductions. Hang on to one of those. Looks like there's plenty for everyone.
All right.
You want one of these, the dino jar?
Yep.
Yeah. Hopefully, in a couple of weeks, we'll add to it.
You want me to
come out? Do you have, oh, that's where I'm going to get it. Okay, do you have
shirts,
a presentation on this?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, the dino monument. So when we lived in the basin, that's what my kids always called it when they were like, let's go to the dino monument.
No, I noticed a couple typos on there. It's like, on the thing, it's like, those weren't on the original. I don't think there's a spell checker in that thing.
It's
a lot of words that
all work. You know, my real nemesis are spell checkers. There's ones in changing scientific words to gobbledygook.
Yeah.
Is Buckhorn part of the Cedar Mountains?
Hmm?
Is Buckhorn part
yeah,
of
it
is.
Yeah, it's the lower
basal conglomerate.
So is there something in between the Buckhorn part of the Cedar Mountain between Buckhorn and the Morrison?
Morrison?
On the
no,
base
but,
of Cedar Mountain.
But you, well, you have interfluvial stuff
okay.
lateral to it. It. You know, it isn't, you know, it's a river system.
Yeah.
And it's not continuous. It's actually, it actually bifurcates and comes together.
Okay.
Okay.
I
hiked
up that face.
Oh,
sorry.
Or
and there are a lot of places where the conglomerates ain't cemented up there. So it's a slope form,
which,
you got to dig in.
Rick, is it on a jump drive of Pam?
It's on a jump drive of Pam's in Indiana. Okay, this is Marcus.
It's already on the computer.
Well, yeah, but it's on, it's on local. Sorry, it's on local. You log out and log in. Now, why don't you start after it?
All right.
Introduce
so somebody getting that file.
Now I'd have to go.
Previous proposal.
Oh, Pam's got it on there.
Yeah, so we'll have to wait for English.
But you can start.
All right. So, yeah, the paleo program.
Well, this is Grant Willis, who's program manager of geologic mapping. And I guess why we're featuring this is paleo section has been with groundwater for 20 years. I've been here anyway. Long time. And we've never wanted to rock the boat, but eventually we realized the expertise that sits with the paleo are way better sitting as a, sitting inside mapping than they are sitting with the groundwater team. Because it used to be way back environmental sciences. So we made the move so that structurally, financially, whatever, they're inside mapping. So Grant's going to sort of tell us how the fit's going to work.
All right. So, yeah, I guess, you know, if you know, you are new, so I'm Grant Willis. I'm kind of the old geezer around here. I've been with the UGS for 34 years now, and I've been manager of the mapping program for 25, which has got to be some kind of record. But anyway, and I love it. I love geologic mapping, and my boss who hired me is almost 90 now, and he's still making geologic maps for us. so I think that'll be me.
We're hoping.
Unless my wife just throws a total rebellion. That's what I'll be doing when I retire. Okay, so anyway, as Rick said, you know, it was a good opportunity to move Paleo over into the mapping program, so we consider it a group within mapping. We still keep a separate budget. Their personnel are kind of tracked and separately from the rest of the mappers.
Just dogs.
There are a couple of things that it does. You know, we are trying to slowly kind of integrate their GIS needs with the mapping GIS needs. Of course, secretary, you know, they're under our same secretary, things like that. But, you know, as for me, you know, it was just an added responsibility. I mean, I didn't lose any responsibilities when this came on. I just got another one. And it makes sense. It's a good fit. But, you know, I review a lot of materials for Jim. And by the way, I think you know there's three people in Paleo. Jim Kirkland, Don DeBlue, and Mark Hayden. And Jim can tell you a little bit more about the responsibilities and what each of them do. But, you know, so managing, reviewing, and then probably the biggest time commitment for me is just, you know, those planning, discussions, stick your head in the door meetings, all those types of things that happen, you know, when you're working with an active group who's doing a lot of different things. GIS is an issue for us because it just happened to that this took place just after we lost one of our three GIS positions in mapping. So Zach Anderson, who was our new GIS person, but he's really a geologist and geologic mapper at heart, threw us an ultimatum a couple of years ago and said, "Hey, I want to be a mapper and I've got a job in Montana, so take your pick." And so we made him a mapper. So put us one short on GIS people. So we're struggling with that a little bit with this new addition because they do have quite a bit of GIS that they do. We all do. It's just natural, you know. But anyway, I really enjoy working with all three of them. They're good people. They're good scientists. And I think what's most important, I really believe in the importance of paleontology to the state of Utah. You know, it's hard to put a dollar value on it, but it's part of our image. It's just part of Utah's persona is we have important dinosaurs, but also a lot of other fossil resources. So, you know, there is a huge positive financial benefit from that I think we all recognize to tourism, economy, research dollars, and again, just, you know, all these connections that have of what Utah is. It's also a very important scientific resource. You know, and it's not just our dinosaurs. We have a lot of important invertebrates as well, and mammals, and a lot of other categories of fossils, plant resources that are very important on the worldwide scene, and have brought Utah a lot of worldwide recognition. So to me, what the paleontology program is about is to preserve, protect, and wisely promote Utah's fossil resources. And to me, that's the mission of the paleontology group. You know, as we all know, you know, when these resources are gone for whatever reason, whether it was appropriate at the time or not, when they're gone, they're gone. They're never going to be replaced, and we need to always have that in our mind with everything we do. You know, to preserving, protecting, sometimes it means things. I mean, always it involves a partnership. UGS owns no land. You know, we really don't even own fossils. You know, we're a protector and a manager of those resources. So it always involves partnerships with museums, with the BLM, the Forest Service, the Park Service, state lands, whoever, private landowners. There's some kind of a partnership going on always. And that's a big challenge. I think Jim will tell you a little bit more about that. But we're always trying to work out, you know, and keep everybody's feathers not unruffled and, you know, all those things that are involved in partnerships. But, you know, sometimes it's something like building a fence, you know, or increasing patrolling of an area. You know, sometimes it's the proper thing to do is to collect the resource and get it into a museum. But a lot of decisions have to be made, mostly by Jim, on what is the proper resource thing to do, because we do see a lot of issues. Just people love fossils, and they love them to death, which is not intended as a pun, though I guess it is kind of a pun. Anyway, so, you know, trying to help promote these wisely at the same time protecting them is just a constant challenge. Just a couple of examples. Jim's going to talk to you about the Dalton Wells site, so I won't say much about it other than where it's a site that's getting loved to death, and something's got to be done, or there's just going to be irreparable damage to that site. There already is irreparable damage going on there. The mega block, I think most of you are aware of the mega block. Are you going to mention that?
I'm going to mention that.
Okay,
there's a lot of stuff to mention.
Yeah, more than we could possibly do in this time. But anyway, the mega block is a big challenge for us. And then there's just this growing interest by rock hounders, fossil collectors, pseudoscientists, you know, some innocent, some not so innocent, and of course, many of our resources are being exploited for financially. I mean, they're worth a lot of money, you know, and so people go out on these sites and dig illegally, and that's a big issue. And of course, just flat out vandalism, you know, from things like driving four-wheelers over the tops of dinosaur tracks to blatant vandalism. Those are all issues. So anyway, that's a very whirlwind of what I see is in the paleo program, and you know, we're constantly discussing these issues and working on them. And so I guess if there's any questions or before we turn it over to Jim, he's really going to give you the details here today, but that was kind of a quick view.
Just out of curiosity, if something's on BLM land, what sort of authority or jurisdictional problems, how do you work those out as far as who manages it?
Jim?
Yeah. Well, basically, the BLM, you know, permits, you know, their land. But we advise with them. We have an MOU with the BLM because of, you know, we host the database for localities in Utah. And we are the standard that they tell the rest of the country should be following for how to record these things and how to manage them. As you'll hear in a minute, Utah has been far ahead of the rest of the country, including the federal government, regarding management of paleo resources. We're the first state to have laws regarding paleontology, you know, before the federal government ever did.
Does the Forest Service participate in this database?
They do, but they don't talk to us nearly like the BLM does. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I think they took some offense at the governor's comments on the PURPA rules, the Paleo Resource Protection Act rules that came out a few years ago by the Forest Service, which I wrote in the governor passed them on. They were needed to be stated. But Forest Service, they aren't, you know, they do stuff, we work with them, but not to the same level. BLM is, we work a lot. They give us a lot more money. Forest Service has funded us once. BLM funds us nearly every year, as does Park Service. And we get a lot of funds. That's our biggest source of outside money at those agencies.
And in the powers and duties, there's a list of 20 odd of them, but there's four relevant to paleontology. Stimulate research, study, and activities in the field of paleontology. Mark, protect, preserve critical paleontological sites. Collect, preserve, administer critical paleontological specimens until they are placed in a repository or curation facility. And administer critical paleontological site excavation records. Anyway, go for it, Jim.
Jim?
All right. Do I have something to advance? Some PowerPoint?
I think it's up there now.
I could do that for you.
I mean, I'm just so excited to use the mouse to do things.
I can do it for you if you'd like.
Okay, sure. Okay, I'll probably just jump to the next one, just an overview of our program. And the first thing, you know, was suggested that we just go over the Utah code regarding paleo. The first one, yeah. And these are the parts in terms of the code regarding the powers and duties of the survey. These are the general statements regarding paleontology in the state. And basically assist state, local governments, subdivisions, you know, geology. Paleo is listed with this stuff now. Stimulate research, study, and activities in the field of paleontology. which I always think of as kind of being the cheerleader for Utah paleontology. And we have the best record of the history of life of any spot of this geographic size on planet Earth. And that is a fact that I have no problem spouting at any drop of hat anywhere. Of course, collect, preserve, administer critical specimens. You get a call, there's something, you know, that's in danger or something, it's been tripped over or partially excavated by some citizens, you know, not knowing that we're probably supposed to excavate and we're supposed to, you know, deal with this type of thing. You know, we're supposed to be the fallback for anything that happens. And this is basically just covering the state of Utah. And we keep the database, and that is probably one of our strongest assets. That's the thing that I always fear the BLM is going to take from us, because, you know, there's a lot of agencies, Park Service, that's not thrilled that we have more data than they have regarding some of this stuff, and it published critical reports. And that's the statewide stuff. Next. Now, CITLA, state lands, a lot more. When it comes to the lands, and it's the state and its subdivisions, as you can see, there are a whole series of laws regarding this, and certainly more than any other state in the nation. I've talked to a lot of people over the years, but this is all mainly tied to CITLA, but also sovereign land, and even things like Mount Bell Reservoir, which is city of Salt Lake. We deal with things there as well. Next, you know, in general, you know, protect, you know, the materials on school trust lands. And legislature finds that this is an appropriate thing that we should be doing, that within the scope of trust lands, protecting these resources for the benefit of our citizens is a worthy endeavor. Next, we issue the permits for all work on state lands in Utah. And these are required, you know, we've set this up. We pretty much follow national standards at a graduate degree or equivalent experience in field research and paleontology is required. I basically decide who's qualified to be doing research on our lands in Utah. We generally try to follow the same groups that the Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, Park Service would follow on that. But one thing we need is a letter repository. And that's issued by the Natural History Museum of Utah. And I'll mention that here again in a second. But we need to get that letter before I can sign a permit. And that goes to the permittee. And then the CITLA needs to give them a right of entry. So, you know, you need permission from the agency managing that particular parcel of land before you can go in there and extract fossils as well. So we have three steps. But we can issue our permits generally in a few days, generally about on order of tenfold faster than any other agency in the nation. Because we just do it. We know who deserves to be doing this and why they, you know, get these permits. And also, of course, there's criminal penalties for these things if you're breaking the law and stealing our state resources. Next. Now, outside funding to the survey has largely been pursuant to this right here, where in the power and duties of the survey, it doesn't say paleo, but specifically, but quasi-government agencies, federal agencies, schools of higher education. This is what allows us to be getting funds from other areas. That's the Park Service, the BLM, a little bit from the Forest Service. And a big thing is the State Paleo Register. The Utah Locality Database has brought in a lot of grant money over the years, the BLM, you know, having us work on it. You know, we really need to bring it up into a GIS ArcView standard. And we're also wanting to develop it so it can be used online by various companies doing mitigation.
So yeah. You're saying it's not spatial?
It is spatial. We are tied to ArcView, but we need it to be kind of more seamless.
Right.
And there are people in the BLM working on this, which it scares me, you know, because they have their ArcView. GIS specialists now redoing how database is done in different other states, and I'm getting real scared. They're going to say, "Well, we don't need you guys anymore, so we're going to take all the BLM data." you know, but we have an obligation to look at more than just BLM. We do Forest Service, Park Service, state lands, all lands within the borders of Utah.
So you're saying the BLM is redesigning?
They've got people working on it, as well as giving us money to redesign it. Unfortunately, we've had a funny track record with that. The first time they gave us big money to update the database, they wanted us to do some pass-through money to a woman that worked with the BLM on this type of thing. Mm-hmm. She actually then passed it on through to a friend in Texas, and we ended up with something that basically collapsed our system for several years. It was useless. This person, like, you give me more money and I'll work on it, I guess.
So if
this Texas group. I mean, you know, stepped down the line out of our hands. So then we tried to do it in time. We ended up having interns do it, which ended up not having the, you know, no, really being able to do it. We ended up with something that wasn't that useful.
Well, do you
so
have,
we're using the one we've used for 20 years.
So in people reworking this, do they have you established functional and technical requirements for that design?
Yeah. And we're the standard as it is now. Our data required for the database that we established soon after I took this position. The BLM, you know, basically they're the standards they require of everybody. You know, we're still held up as the only state with a useful and good locality database at state level that is tied to GIS. You know, we can, you know, get a polygon, you know, say a national park or a county or some other geographic unit and tell you where every single locality is, what formation and a great deal of information. We could tell you, you know, give you all that GIS data. No other state has that ability. And even the ones that are redoing the computer work for this, and I'm not a computer programmer. Part of the problem with our group is we're scientists. You know, no one's a database person specifically in our group. But basically, we, you know, had this ability. Other states don't have the data. You know, they may have a better, more streamlined program, but they have 1,000 localities. We've got over 10,000 localities in our database. Throughout Utah, we're, you know, almost probably tenfold any other state.
The nice thing is it's statewide. You know, it's seamless in essence. Whereas if the BLM does theirs, you know how spotty BLM land is. You leave out critical sites, and it, you know, it's part of the big picture, and so it needs to reside with somebody.
And what we have, you know, it's part of our state laws. I mean, you know, and I do think we have a right to know what's going on within our borders. You know, so this, you know, this whole thing, it always bothers me because you always have people that, you know, we want control. Park Services is much stronger this way. We have most of the park data, except for Dinosaur National Monument. You know, we don't have virtually any data. You know, Dinosaur National Monument, we got off of Google Earth. You know, oh, there it is. Let's put it in our database. But they're, you know, very tight with their data. Next. Basically, the ownership of collections, you know, the material remains the property of the state territories in which it's from, whether it's the city of Salt Lake, SITLA, sovereign lands, etc. But they're kept in repository, which is, you know, the main repository in the state is the Natural History Museum of Utah. The state of Utah funds half of their budget, you know, goes, you know, right from our legislature to them. So this is part of their responsibilities. So every single repository, other than themselves, needs a letter of repository, which they issue. And the only four institutions in our state that get these are themselves, Vernal Fieldhouse, BYU, and Utah State. And they have to reapply every year. Every time they get a permit, they need a new letter. And literally, if there's a site they'd rather keep at the U, they can do it. They can tell BYU, well, we're taking that because that's a real nice specimen. And which I think is a real buy. You know, I don't think that's the way it should be done, but that is the way it's done. There's two institutions in Utah, I think, that are qualified and want to be state repositories, Museum of Moab, which is now just became a federal repository a couple weeks ago, and the St. George Dinosaur Discovery Site. They both have paleontologists on staff, but they're not a repository. And the state of Utah, the museum, is harder to get them to recognize you than the federal government is right now. And I think they like St. George sending all their stuff and Moab. sending all their stuff up to the U once they do all the work on it. Anyway, I'm trying to help them out. Now, landmarks, we've never done this. We have the ability to designate paleontological landmarks with the cooperation of various landowners. One of the reasons it hasn't been done is we're going to be putting a big red flag on sites. You know, here's a site. But there are places that are already set up for interpretation that this might make sense, like Dinosaur Quarry, Dinosaur National Monument, Cleveland Lloyd Quarry, St. George Dinosaur Discovery Site, Mill Canyon, some of the interpretive trails in the Moab area, Copper Ridge Site, Dalton Wells, as we'll talk about in a little bit. You know, these are places that, you know, having, you know, things saying these are real important. And we've already been contacted by the federal government regarding Dalton Wells because they'd like to make it a national historic site for fossil resources, or site of natural significance or something of that sort, a new category that they're putting together through the Park Service. Next. Basically, people are supposed to report the discovery sites on state or private lands. You know, I don't tend to try to shake the tree too much on private land in Utah, but that is the way the rules. So you're basically supposed to report to us when sites are discovered on state or private lands. We have the state register, and we are the national standard for that. And the agency is responsible. Yeah, other agencies in the state are responsible to the director of the survey, Rick, and I'm designated to deal with this, to talk about potential problems with sites, the RDCC process, where there's going to be land disturbing activity, road expansions. We go through that process. Is it going to potentially destroy a site? And we deal with that. And we deal with it every Monday, deal with RDCC. Next. We also, one of the things that were set up by my predecessor, Dave Gillette, was to develop curriculum materials for Utah Friends of Paleo so they could have training on how to help professional paleontologists in Utah. Fortunately, they spent all the money before I had this job and ended up with no resources from that. But we're really excited because we're working with Utah Friends of Paleo and one of the new PhDs from the U, and are putting together an online training program. So everyone in the state will be able to benefit from it, as opposed to just coming up and taking a class, which was the old way things were done. The museum in Price had a really good program that was like a three-day weekend, you know, eight-hour days, crank them through the whole program, but you had to go to Price to do it, pretty expensive. Next. Now, just kind of go through Utah's paleo, it's extraordinary. One of the things we've been doing with the BLM, and we have a big grant to try to create justifications for it, are what we call paleosensitivity maps. They call PFYCs, potential fossil yield classification maps. They like acronyms more than I like. I never can remember them. But this is the first map I generated, took a weekend ArcView course and generated that off our state map in terms of the potential for fossil resources in various formations to try to make it pretty clear. The only one that was five, the way it was mapped, was the Morrison. But you go into greater detail, you would have more fives than that map particularly shows, because you're lumping things together and needing to average things. But we're working on a big project now. It's going to take multiple years to create a publication that justifies the PFYC scores, which are from the BLM, has 1 to 5. There's nothing called a 0 except for water or, say, a dam. So basalt flows are 1. It may be a fossil in a basalt flow, you know, or granite. I think they should be 0 too, but we don't agree. But we're going to justify this with our bibliography of paleo resources in Utah, which is almost comprehensive. It's pretty good. And put this out as a publication so people know why we think a place should be mitigated or there should be someone on site when some disturbance occurs. There's actually some legal justification. Next.
Oh, one quick question about that.
Yeah.
Is there a GIS file layer for this sensitivity?
That's what we're producing now. The BLM has done their own stuff with FD 30 by 60 maps by calling into me and just reading me map names and having me tell them what I think, what numbers you get. Yeah. From the hip, that's going to hold up in court real well. Yeah. So that's why we're trying to do this.
Well,
but the BLM, we have the state map that CITLA uses, so anything that goes from 3 up, you know, they pay attention to.
This is currently available in GIS?
I'm not sure if it's on our site or not. CITLA uses it.
I don't think it's on our site.
So here's the reason I'm saying
that. Because I know CITLA's using
that. The Bears Ears and the Forest Service are heavily involved in planning right now.
Mm-hmm.
If they could overlay this with
we provided maps specifically to Bears Ears, Grand Staircase. You know, we've got much more detailed things.
And even the Wasatch Plateau. Mm-hmm. They're right in the middle of planning, so that's what I'm saying.
The governor's office has these things from us.
But I work with their planning team.
Some of this stuff is not open to the public because it's sensitive information, too.
Well, I'll check with you later, but we need to get that to them so they have it for their planning process.
Yeah.
Well, certainly at this level, they can have this map.
Oh, yeah.
As a GIS layer.
As a GIS.
Yeah, okay. Very good.
Site information.
Yeah, but the site stuff, we're definitely the MOUs. There's a federal law that says you cannot release locality data. We can with the state, but I don't think the state would like that either. Now, you know, we were the first place in the West to find dinosaurs. You know, and I'm known for dinosaurs. I work everywhere in the Mesozoic. And the first site found was during the Mankam surveys of the West. John Newberry found Dystrophius alpha Moab. It had been lost for years. Fran Bonds at Moab did historical research and relocated the site, which is being excavated by the Museum of Moab with everything going to the Utah Museum of Natural History. But it's real interesting. This is the number one specimen. You know, Smithsonian Natural History Museum, United States, 0001 is that skeleton or parts of that skeleton. That were found back then. So it's the first specimen in our National Museum. Next. Of course, you know, we're famous for the Morrison, the Carnegie quarry there, Dinosaur National Monument. It's been closed for years, but the new visitor center's open, and it's quite a nice place. Next, Cleveland Lloyd Quarry. You know, first state paleontologist Jim Madsen. Basically the state paleontology position was started when the university decided to get out of the dinosaur business for a while, and Lee Stokes basically talked to some of his friends in the legislature and created this whole state paleo program, which to build upon the Cleveland Lloyd collections that all got transferred to the Division of State History at that time. And now there's a new BLM facility on site. Next. Of course, then the next big thing that had been discovered here were the Smithsonian expeditions into the North Horn. You know, Gilmore described Alamosaurus from up there, a really nice skeleton. This is a mounted skeleton now, at least the hind end of it's from the North Horn, and the front end is actually from Big Bend, Texas. This is a late Cretaceous sauropod. Next. This is latest Cretaceous. So here's Alamosaurus. This whole back end is from Utah on the front end. The neck is a specimen from Big Bend, Texas. That's a big T-Rex next to it. Alamosaurus is a big animal. And the North Horn Formation is the only place in the world where we have T-Rex and a big sauropod in the same rocks. You know, and this is an animal that probably re-entered North America from Asia along the Pacific coast and then kind of came in through Vegas into the southern park. His closest relatives are in Mongolia for that animal. We also have Utah's first horned dinosaur, Torosaurus utahensis. And it's an animal that still needs a lot of research. And that's a T-Rex skull, the back end of it, from the North Horn. Next. Now, the next thing that happened in Utah was the work by BYU at Yellow Cat, you know, big discoveries, and I'm looking at Morrison work of Jim Jensen, which was largely in Colorado, by the way, not in Utah. But the BYU digs at Dalton Wells, you know, the greatest view sheds of any sites. Moabosaurus was just named a few months ago. There's been mounted skeletons around the world of this animal for over 20 years, so it's really nice to see a real name put on it officially. And Moab is trying to get someone to come down and speak about it at some point. And unfortunately, I guess they're pretty busy up at the Y. Next. Very soon thereafter, I was lucky enough to get involved with this site, the Gaston Quarry at just across Arches from Dalton Wells, where I was able to find parts of the first Utah raptor and Gastonia, the best, you know, polacanthid specimens ever found in the world. We actually know what this group, you know, is like now from these specimens. These both occur at Dalton Wells as well. There's parts of 8 Utah raptors at Dalton Wells. There's only one at this quarry, but we were able to show it was one individual. Next. Of course, in 1996, Grand Staircase Escalante was designated. The thing that happened with that helped paleo in Utah, there was actually some money at that point to do some work down there. I'd worked down there in the 80s looking at microvertebrates, fossil mammals, and things of that sort. And once 96, around 2000, all of a sudden when they had the management plan, there was funding to do work down there. This led to huge numbers of discovery, except no one had ever done anything there. There were like 2 specimens known. And now there's 1,800 sites, I think, now for dinosaurs alone in the Grand Staircase, one of the richest spots on planet Earth for dinosaurs. But mammals, the little stuff, led the way for the work we did in the 80s. Next. Now, this is what I just passed out to you. This is the up-to-date chart of the dinosaurs of Utah. And up to when I named Utah Raptor in 93, we knew many of these Morrison animals. We knew a few Northhorn animals, Alamosaurus, and didn't know about T-Rex there at the time, and Torosaurus. We had a couple fossils misnamed from the Caparowitz there, Grand Staircase. That's about it. Everything else we've described and discovered since 1993. So in the last 25 years, all of that's come to light over just three levels that had fossils before. And this is, with 27 non-overlapping sequential dinosaur faunas, the most complete dinosaur bearing sequence on planet Earth. And because of this, I know my colleagues in Europe are real interested in what we're doing here, and had me go consult with them, the Chinese, because they have great records. They have these feathered dinosaurs and things. But they got a feathered dinosaur site here, here, and here. This is what we got. We have the complete record. And we are the keystone to understanding the history of the Mesozoic in the entire Northern Hemisphere. There's no doubt about it, and it's much better dated than anywhere else in the world. Next. We also have, you know, as Grant pointed out, a great fauna of invertebrates in the West Desert. Probably, you know, this is the tight Cambrian-Ordovician boundary is over there now. Several type stage boundaries in the Cambrian have been placed in the West Desert. The early parts of the Age of Mammals from the Northhorn Paleocene and the Uinta Basin Eocene. We have one of the best records of these sequences. But we have every stage of the Tertiary recorded with fossil mammal skeletons. You know, the most complete sequence of life in any geographic area of this size on planet Earth. Next. Now, we've been, you know, I'm known more for the dinosaur stuff, but, you know, so we'll mainly look at the Mesozoic here. But the Triassic, this is the head of Rainbow Canyon near Red Canyon. Red Canyon's off that way. Rainbow Canyon is more this way. We have a lot of sites in this area. This is just to the west of Bear's Ears. It's not included. This is, there are a lot of uranium mines here in the Chinarump. So this place was set aside outside of Bear's Ears. Lake Powell's right over here by where I'm standing. It's an amazing sequence. You know, it's one of the best Triassic sequences you'll ever find anywhere. And it's very, very fossiliferous. Next. But we've been working in that. We've been funded through the National Park Service to look at the Chinle in the national park. So Capitol Reef, Arches, they want us in Canyonlands, Zion, we've done a lot of work on. This is largely, this right here is kind of based on our work at Capitol Reef, where we've been finding sites. These are all new sites we found during a 10-day survey of these rocks. You know, we more than doubled all the known sites in Glen Canyon in 11 days when we went in there, so we know what we're doing. next. We also have been developing, these are all from state land in Lisbon Valley, a place where I want to name Schaefer Ridge. American Museum went in there after the Iranian bulldozers, and all these beautiful fossil fish sites. This is a skull of a 2-meter-long Vitosaur Triassic thing that looks a lot like a crocodilian but isn't, but it's one of the biggest skulls of one ever found anywhere in the world. It's up at the U. We want to get it. Zion would love a cast of it because it's found right outside the park. The work we're doing with Chinle, we're coming up with a very different story than Chinle. This will be published in the next couple weeks through the Geology of the Intermountain West. Another about 100-page overview of the stratigraphy of the Upper Triassic across Utah, going park for park. Take-home message, because there's things I don't agree with my senior author on this, is the big truncation thickening and then truncation of the upper part as you go west. This is a real interesting revelation. The reason we know this is because of the fossils and biostratigraphy. You know, when people ask me, you know, what are you as a scientist? I'm a biostratigrapher. I did theoretical biostratigraphy for my PhD in the Marine Cretaceous. So that's what I do, is date rocks, correlate rocks, based on their fossil content. And it's giving us a very different view of what's going on in the Triassic here. Next. We've been working with Zion, St. George Dinosaur Discovery Site, on the Triassic-Jurassic boundary. Have a paper that was published 2 days ago in the Earth and Planetary Science Letters about this sequence, this Black's Canyon in the eastern part of Zion. And we've been basically trying to figure out what's going on with the Triassic-Jurassic boundary. We have some evidence, a camp, the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province excursion occurs right in that level at the base of the Whitmore Point member. Unfortunately, the International Stratigraphic Commission put the Triassic-Jurassic boundary. We think it's up in here now. But the extinction boundary at the end of the Triassic is well below it. So the actual boundary between the Triassic and Jurassic is kind of boring. But the big extinction boundary that allowed dinosaurs to take over the planet occurs well below it. And we think both are in the Mo-Wenave in the southwestern part of our state, making this a critical place. This will be part of a field trip to the North American Coring Program at the end of September. We just found out they're putting me as a co-author of this because they're clipping out a lot of our stuff from our papers. I think they've already written the thing. I haven't even seen it. But I just was informed of this 2 days ago. Next. I won't be on the field trip, though, even though my name will be on it. They're meeting at Flagstaff, but are touring across Utah. Of course, the track site is probably one of my best accomplishments, is working with Sheldon Johnson and his family in the state of Utah to build this beautiful facility over the track site. You got to see it. The new mural, it's got the second largest mural in the state of Utah, showing the coastline of the seaway, beautifully done. It took 6 months to paint the mural across one whole side of the building, matching right up to the tracks themselves. So it's seamless with the track site. Biggest area of swim tracks anywhere in the world. We probably have 300 major blocks with swim tracks on them, or floundering tracks, as I like to call them. Next. But we've been working with these. We do get bones and fish in the area with these lake beds. Once again, the Triassic-Jurassic boundary is an area of interest. We have the only plant localities found at the Triassic-Jurassic boundary anywhere, of which every plant's been a new species. One's named St. Georgia for St. George. We've got dinosaur remains as well. Next. You know, we defined this lake system as Lake Dixie. You know, when things were dry, we had an inland delta, like in Botswana, the Okavango Delta of Botswana. as an inland delta when things are dry, like in the Kayenta, and Dinosaur Canyon member of the Moanabe. That delta just died in the St. George area. But when things were wetter, we have Lake Dixie in this area. We have a similar lake in the Kayenta Formation as well. So whenever it was wet, we get this big lake system down there. That hadn't been recognized until we started this work down there. Next. As we go up into the Kayenta Formation, once again, you know, this is the Whitmore Point. Lower Kayenta is wet. This is an unconformist Springdale sandstone, the base of the Kayenta. But we have sites now in the Kayenta producing lots of dinosaur teeth, more fossil fish, giant fishes, in fact, in that lake system. But as you go through here, it gets drier and drier, get inland sockas that are finally covered by the Navajo's sand sea. Next. Of course, we're working Lake Powell quite a bit, and this is our image of the interfingering of the Kayenta and Navajo in the Lake Powell region, where we mostly see tracks, but the animal skeletons are known from the Navajo Reservation. Next. Basically, just to jump into the Upper Jurassic, I've been working with colleagues in Portugal, kind of wrestling with this because I think there's a bigger connection than they do, but literally, you could walk from the Iberian Peninsula into North America, the Upper Jurassic. There's four or five dinosaurs that we have in the Morrison of Utah that also occur in Portugal, the same taxa. So, you know, they're not swimming in the Atlantic. This is showing the Atlantic heading quite open at that point. And it's pretty exciting, you know, in my mind, mainly because of my work in the Cretaceous. Next. But we have a new project going on, Western Blanding Basin along Coombs Ridge. Or, you know, we say Western Blanding Basin, bear's ears. we try to avoid using that term. But this is the type area for the Bluff Sandstone member of the Morrison, the Recaptor member of the Morrison, the Westwater member of the Morrison, and the Brushy Basin member of the Morrison. And there really hasn't been any decent work here, as far as I'm concerned. The USGS has been wrong. The New Mexico people who came up here trying to figure it out, they've been really wrong. So we're going to be, this September, with funding from the BLM, measuring these sections in detail. We're going to really going to publish the new brushy section, because most of the dinosaurs are in the brushy. And we now have a new radiometric date right under the Barrow Canyon Formation of 150.6 plus or minus around 300,000 years. That's the best known Morrison date from this ash we found. We've just submitted another ash to be dated. BLM's paying for these dates, which is always nice. His dates, as a biostratigrapher, I like to link things to true time wherever I can. And basically, we have another site with a good ash that I expect another good date on. So I'm pretty excited about that. But we'll be back down there in September measuring sections. And, you know, Grant, we haven't mapped a lot of this area. There's nothing but photogeologic maps from the 50s. And we want to do some real mapping, and Grant wants to figure out what are the mapping surfaces we should be using down here. And that's one of our targets, is figure out what are sensible mapping surfaces. This stuff up here at the top of the Westwater looks like the Barrow Canyon. It isn't. That's the top. This part is probably equivalent to the salt wash. That part is actually up in the brushy. I can pretty much prove that. I'm now calling it the No Man's Island beds. And I'm wondering if we really do need to recalibrate what's going on there. But I have a scientist from New Mexico coming up, and we're going to see how it fits with the stuff in the Grants Uranium bed.
That'll be interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Kate will be really helpful. She'll be there for these 6 days of this. Next. Of course, some of you have heard about the Mega Block, Stites Quarry. The Cedar Mountain has been a big focus of my work, much of my career. But when this thing was found by a grad student, an arm bone sticking out of the rock, looked like a human arm bone. You know, as Don likes to joke, if we knew what we were getting into, we would have walked away. But once you start, you know, once you wound the animal, you got to kill it. And then when you kill it, you got to clean it. You know, that's kind of how it works.
And haul it out.
Yeah, more haul it out. But this is an extraordinary site. We've published in Paleos that this is, and this came out last year, that this is the only site
has ever been published where the reason for mass mortality is quicksand, a big dewatering feature. And the Paleos paper is, you know, like 30 pages. It's quite a nice paper. I almost wanted to put it up for consideration for the Crawford because I'm really proud of it. I figured this out because of a field trip where Mark was standing right next to me looking off that rest area, that Lake Powell trip. That's what we got. He saw my eyes hit that revelation. Amazing site, a lot of work. Next. You know, this is going to show us the growth history of what I think is going to be a pack of Utah raptors. You know, taking it down was a great undertaking. Scrounging for money, getting people, Dan Harrison, Green River, High Desert Excavation, worked on this stuff for us at cost, basically gas money, and replacing the blowouts on the semi, bringing the equipment in. Two blowouts, bringing the equipment in. Getting the permits from CITLA to put a road into the site. You know, we hoped for a helicopter. 3 years later, we didn't get it, so we had to get it off the hill. And this is down Thanksgiving Point, and we're trying to get this thing funded. You probably saw the thing in survey notes. We're still looking to get money. Because of rain, I missed a meeting with George Lucas and Warren Buffett a couple weeks ago. I was supposed to have dinner with them to talk about geology in the Moab area.
Could have just collected the tip off the table and had
it. rained 15 hours.
I'll get dinner. You get the dinosaurs.
15 hours of spray rain down there. Can you predict that? And they didn't get to camp either. So if I'd gotten out of camp, I would have got to their camp. Actually, I couldn't have because of the big lake between their camp and anything else. And they wouldn't have been there. It was just a disaster. More after that much mud in the main streets. So it's just, what do you do? But at the end of September, we're going to be at Comic-Con. They're giving us a free booth. They're going to be in a panel. 120,000 people, two-thirds of them put a dollar each in. We'll be funded for this next year for this preparation of these fossils. So, we'll be having that prominently on the sign. Dollar each, this project is covered. And then we're going to hopefully be at the APG meeting, also with a booth asking for money as well. So APG, there's a few deep pockets there. But this is, normally Discovery Channel would be funding this, but Reality TV killed that golden goose. Next. Other upper, yellow cat dinosaurs, Moabosaurus, Cedarsaurus, Hippodraco, one of our animals, sailback animals next. This is mostly our work. Ned Colbertia, we're actually presenting a paper at SVP this year on this with Rebecca Hunt in Moab. It's an ornithomimid, one of the ostrich mimics, the oldest one in North America, maybe the oldest one in the world, actually. We have the oldest North American bird tracks, which may also be the oldest bird tracks in the world. We're pretty excited about that. Next. We have a new crocodilian, working with the Denver Museum to name that. Sphenodontids, there's an Argentinian that really wants to work on the skull we got with us pretty badly. We got CT data on it now, which I don't know how to deal with. And we found a mammal, big mammal, skulls this long. This mammal, next slide, has turned out to be a prize. Working with the folks at University of Southern California, the medical school, University of Chicago, Xi Shui Lao, who does all the Chinese stuff, was basically single-handedly named all these. From China, from one of their feathered dinosaur sites in the Upper Jurassic. But our beast, Cephalodon, falls in with this group, and these are pre-mammals. These are mammaliforms, not true mammals. They're tied to this group called the Haramaiids. And one of the things that's really exciting, it's the first Cretaceous Haramaiid ever found, first one ever found in North America, but it has a link to this group, the Gondwanotheres. I used to think came out of the multituberculates. We are not hedging our bets. The Gondwanotheres, a major aberrant southern hemisphere group, his closest relatives of things like Cephalodon from Utah. So a fossil from Utah is basically telling us what's going on in South America. Additionally, the links of this animal, Haniodon from North Africa and Spain, shows it has a link with Europe again. And this has been one of my big pushes for the Yellow Cat Bond, is the European connection. And towards North Africa, Europe, and to Utah. So this is going to come out in Science, hopefully in a few weeks. Next. And bringing in people to know more than me is why we got this figured out. You know, collaboration is everything. We discovered an older fauna. This is probably the oldest Cretaceous fauna in North America, at Doling's Bowl, and up at, in south of Utah, south of Green River, Don's Ridge, Crystal Geyser sites. Way down, we've had to move the base of the Cedar Mountain down section. Next. And these sites, you know, we've got Falcarius, Iguana colossus, tons of Iguana colossus at Dolan's Bowl, probably 30 individuals now. We have a new sauropod that was mired, so its legs were stuck in the mud, and over a period of a week plus, probably it died. The bones above the mud got scattered around, but this is the most complete Cretaceous sauropod ever found in North America. Next, because we got a lot of skull material. This is some of the material we have. This is in hopefully final review in Nature, Scientific Reports. The reason Nature is looking at a sauropod is because this is the most primitive sauropod ever found in North America. Even though it's from the Cretaceous, it's a torosaur, and torosaurs are below the Neosauropoda. All North American Morrison and younger sauropods, or Neosauropoda, are up. So this thing, you know, which is from a Jurassic group in Europe and North Africa once again, came in post-Jurassic, because we don't have any evidence of them in the Morrison, and appears here in the Cretaceous. Turns out Moabosaurus is also a torosaur. So we have two different types of torosaurs in the early Cretaceous North America with their roots in Europe. Once again, we're dating the connections with Europe. Next. The reason ours differs from Moabosaurus is we don't have forked ribs. It has forked ribs. That's obvious. There's other features, too, but that's the most obvious, that their necks are really quite different. Next. We also have a new polecanth that I'm working on. You know, people say, what's your expertise? Armored dinosaurs. I'm in the process of revising all the armored dinosaurs in the world with Mark Lowen up at the University of Utah. But we're able to prove that this Stolling's Bowl animal is new based on brain case features, armor features. Next. We just, this past week, put this to bed and walked away. Always hate to do that when there's something good, but this is an articulated skeleton of a smaller nithopod. Maybe it's a juvenile iguana colossus, or it could be new. We can't really tell until we excavate and prepare it. But it's right next to the road. So, you know, we kind of backfilled over it, and hopefully we can get back, and then in a few days we can collect the thing. But, you know, we had to come in here so I could talk to you folks. So we couldn't get it out of the ground. But one thing that's really neat, the second dinosaur ever found, it's had its tail bitten off. Clearly that articulated tail coming down here, it is bitten off, and here's like the heel stub of the next vertebra, half a vertebra of their heel. So the thing didn't die from it, but it did heal. Got a close call. Next. Oh, it doesn't matter. We have an ash from the base of this bed. This is like a couple meters above the Morrison. This is way down Cedar Mountain. It's in the Paradox Basin, which has the oldest stuff. We're going to get that dated with the help of the BLM. They've offered to put the money up. I begged them to do this. So we'll get this site dated, as well as it'll give us a paper on the timing of that gap between the Morrison and the Cedar Mountain, which will be a good paper. Next. Poison strip used to be considered the buckhorn in this part of the world. It isn't. It may tap the buckhorn in the swell, but it certainly, the buckhorn is its park relative to the lower yellow cat. So it's that interval. Full of petrified logs. Next. But one thing about the poison strip is we have good evidence from the animals that have been described from there. Planococca, what I think is Hoplodosaurus, was named as another species of Gastonia, but pretty sure it's the same thing as Hoplodosaurus. That we can correlate this to Lakota in the Black Hills region. Next. And it's this work, that this fauna, this sand shooting out. The Middle Sand is the most widespread unit in the Cedar Mountain. Bob Young recognized this back in the 60s. This was a very important sequence. I think it's marking when the thrust belt was really sending sands out across the plains, that salt tectonics gave us this interval here that exists nowhere else but Grand County, from local subsidence on the north end of the Paradox Basin. So this is elsewhere the oldest Cretaceous we have. And Utah doesn't have just the oldest Cretaceous fauna. We have the two oldest Cretaceous faunas, with this prominent paleosol representing, instead of what the USGS used to think, they used to put the boundary down here, the Jurassic Cretaceous boundary, at least as much as evolutionary time. Four lineages change species across that paleosol. Next. Ankylosaur, as I said, I'm totally revising the whole family tree of all armored dinosaurs. It's a big process. But looking at things like the pelvis, you know, we have the nice new Doling's bull animal there. Looking at armor and how that changes. But we see an interesting thing we noticed as we work this. There was a major faunal turnover at the middle of the Aptian, and where we lose all the polacanthines. This is the group that I work on mainly. And nodosaurs come in, and ankylosaurs in Asia, above this boundary, as close as we can tell. Work in Europe, I was able to show that all the European things are a different group than all the North American things. But this dates both the major global extinction, because the Chinese agree with me on this now in Asia, that it's in the middle of a stage. It's not the end of anything, it's just like kind of in the middle of the Aptian. But it's associated with, you know, volcanic outblowing basalt flows in the Indian Ocean at the Okhotoka Plateau in the Indian Ocean. So we think we have a reason for this extinction event. It also is dating the final connection, because these guys have a common ancestor, even though the first fossils are separate groups, showing that there was a connection across the Atlantic at that point, totally separate from that point on. So that's the final connection we have with Europe right there, the mid-Aptian. Next. And this is all because of Europe, you know, Utah fossils, you know, they're really doing it. You know, the mid-Aptian break, you know, this connection is severed in some of the various scenarios that have been published recently on these scenarios. Next. The Ruby Ranch, next unit up. You know, a lot of carbonates, but this is what basically is more like what we have in the rest of North America. Next. We've been doing a lot of work with the Kansas Geologic Survey at the University of Kansas on stable isotopes of carbon and oxygen. Now I'm working with the students, Selene and Marina Suarez at the University of Arkansas, University of Texas on this. They're carrying on as professors now. They used to be students when we started this work. Here's where the Aptian-Albian boundary is put. And these things, our extinction boundary is here at the basically, actually, poison strip down here is where we see that extinction boundary right above that. But we can correlate really well on carbon isotopes, looking at the overall marine interval. And there's this whole system now for carbon isotope stratigraphy, where they drop it into segments and you identify the segments and correlate. I'm not the expert on this, once again. You collaborate with people that know more than you do. But one of the things that's really exciting, we can show you by the end of the early Cretaceous, severe orogenic belt had snow on it, and down in that carbonate that first appears, that's probably the first part of the rain shadow that we see for that for the severe belt. Next.
So how's you going on timing?
Pretty quick, yeah. Bam, bam, bam. This is the correlation between the Ruby Ranch and the Cloverly of Montana. Next. So we have some similar animals. We're isolated. We're an island continent at this time. Next. That we've been able to show that the Cedar Mountain formation over the Paradox Basin and the Western Swell are almost completely different sequences based on time and lithostratigraphic data. Here's the beginning of the rain shadow at the Calcrete. Next, is the uppermost Cedar Mountain, of course, at the base of the Upper Cretaceous, produces an amazing fauna of microvertebrates. Next, snow in the mountains. There's a lot of groups around the world working out here. Half of all permits issued in North America or in the United States are for Utah. You know, Beale Museum, North Carolina, giant new meat eaters, biggest T-Rex they found. Next. They have a giant ornithomimid. What's exciting here is we've had eggshell there forever. They've identified this thing called Megaelongolithus. That had been recently tied to this animal, Gigantoraptor in China, this giant oviraptor dinosaur. And now the Field Museum people have found a skeleton of a giant, close relative Gigantoraptor here in Utah. And that'll be announced here pretty soon. I think that's coming out in Nature as well. But this is showing this mustn't touch it is the beginning of the Asian connection. They're really excited, as it was I when we first figured this out, that that spans the beginning. We have some holdovers when we were isolated island, and you know the extinction, we're actually recording it in the 1.5 million years represented in the mustn't touch it. So that's going to be real interesting for dating and understanding an immigration-induced extinction. Next. Of course, this is why it was an extinction. First Asian immigration event. Next. So we've got this great record based on the Cedar Mountain Formation, dating, you know, paleogeography from Europe to isolation to Asian connections. Next. The Seaway in the Upper Cretaceous. This is why I did my master's and my PhD on was the Manco Shale. One of my future projects. This is a mural I had constructed for the John Wesley Powell Museum in front of the Mosasaur. I got them. Because I'm a big believer our local institutions, you know, Green River, Utah being one of them, should benefit from what we're doing, you know, in the state with paleontology. That nice cross-section, we tweaked it to be along the highway there. Next. We've discovered the first coniation sites in the world, working with Jeff Eaton at Tropic. And I've got a volunteer, young woman, Maggie Sertich, her folks built the Ruby's Inn, her great-grandfather or something there at Bryce. But she's starting to get us through a little polygamous group to access the only coniation dinosaur sites known anywhere on the planet. So I got my insights straight with Maddie. She'll work it out. Anyway, next. Just close up some of that stuff. Next. Of course, Grand Staircase, we got Diablo out of that, which is still the most primitive of all the centrosaurs known anywhere. Next. That's a beautiful fossil. This thing looks pretty nondescript, but that's going to be a new pachycephalosaur, one of these dome-headed animals. That should come out in about a year or so, working with the Canadians on that. Next. Of course, the blues. There's a bunch of Denver museums in there. All these groups are in there. But what's exciting is right here in Salt Lake City, the mountains, the alluvial fans come right to the sea, just right there at the border with Wyoming. And we have different dinosaurs there, different dinosaurs here. The reason, we think, is basically the whole floodplain pinches out right about here. You know, it's only like 20 miles thick. It's Soldier Summit. You know, it's pretty thin between the you know, the Narrows conglomerate and what you see as you come down Price Canyon. But up here, we got oysters associated with boulders right in there. A lot of this is, you know, oil company provisional data. I wish someone would hurry up and publish it. But we have totally different dinosaurs evolving through time that they have at Dinosaur Prevention Park evolving through the same time interval as tied with paleomagnetics and radiometric dates. Next. So we have this incredible Cretaceous record tied to Grand Staircase, these new faunas, the Coniacian and Santonian, the top of that hill, same access point to that stuff. It's a remarkable record. It really is. The most complete upper Cretaceous record on the planet. Next. Okay, Dalton Wells real quick. Dalton Wells Quarry is one of the biggest early Cretaceous sites out there, tied into a CCC camp for the people that made the trails at Arches. Then became a Japanese internment camp. The quarry is right here, top of the ridge. Next, probably the best view shed of any site you want. Over 3,000 bones are BYU from their work on it. 10 different kinds of dinosaurs. I superimposed those maps on that last figure. Next, here's looking at the site. You know, LaSalle's looking out across at Arches and LaSalle's there. Amazing site. Ongoing vandalism all the time. We're working with the Utah Friends of Paleo and Moab. They go up there about once a week and there's just new holes. And part of the reason is next, oops, sorry, we'll move it back after the next slide. You know, in the 90s, now we can go to this, we just move on. The MOAB brought me in when I was still working in Colorado to talk to them about a state park here. And the Utah legislature gave Grand County money for a feasibility study. They hired an architect, came up with a $15+ million plan. The legislature laughed at him when he wouldn't back off. But all the notes, you know, the transcripts, if that guy had backed down to $5 million that year, he probably would have got it. But he wouldn't, because he had his monument designed. You know, he was going to build a thing like the Eiffel Tower, tilting, was the neck and head of a dinosaur. Body was going to be the building. A big trail to the site was his tail. It's architectural boondock. So never hire an architect to design something like this. Cause, you know, way too costly. Anyway, that was 20 years ago when they laughed at it. Next. But, you know, this place is getting used a lot. There's the site right up there, and actually goes along here, goes on the back of the ridge. It's one of the biggest sites around. But that's stuff that's been open for excavation. Look at all the campers down there at the base, around the backside, tent camping. There's not a single porta potty. There can be 1,000 people here in a spring or fall weekend because camping is so controlled in the Moab area. You know, the state doesn't, we just don't have people to patrol. This is state land, patrol this. But that place will be just filled with people, trash blowing all over the place. It's really sad. People just hike on up. There's our sign, there's the Utah Geological Survey sign up there. And vandalizing the site ongoing, continuously. I get reports of people going up this side and they're seeing other people running down the other side because there's actually an abandoned road that goes up. Next. So we really want to figure out how to keep that from happening. The Moab Museum, you know, is working on building a new museum there, a new museum in Moab, right where the tailings are. They hired a professional paleontologist, John Foster. Good top scientist, good man. They want to become a state repository. They just become a federal repository in the last week or two. And they want to continue the paleo research at Dalton Wells, where they basically do what Bernal, the Fieldhouse, had been supposedly doing with dinosaur. Be the repository, keep the fossils in Bernal, you know, the Fieldhouse, and do the work up at the quarry of the dinosaur. That may get resurrected, because the paleontologist and dinosaur retired. I'm on the committee to hire the new person with Park Service, and they want to reopen their connections with the Vernal Fieldhouse. Maybe all the fossils. They got a nice new collections facility. Next. And basically, last, you know, we have, you know, this is, we're discovering stuff. You know, there's a paper almost every day on fossils from Utah. Literally, almost every day. And we're talking invertebrates and mammals and everything. This is the good old days. I wish I would live to see what it would be like for what we know about this in 50 or 100 years, because we don't know half of what we got now. I mean, as I said, new frontier, these levels that we know their sites and they've never even been collected, of ages never sampled before. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Have any
feel
questions?
Good about with this stuff here.
Does anybody have any questions for Jim?
I mean, we can go have lunch, we can chat.
Yeah, for sure. Is there anything else that we need to worry about? Then we're adjourned at 11:43.
And what were you thinking for lunch, rather than going down the road in Mexican, just across the road? I hadn't tried it out, but a nice Indian.
Yeah, starving Indian.
Across
it's
the
good.
Road, so, yeah. Those
and they're really
lunch.
Nice family.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
The idea behind this was Jim missed out at the summer picnic where he won the award, the cooperative award for the most prestigious publication on Utah geology. Pub's talking about, or written about, what he's been talking about. So this was a chance to just recognize that.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to go to China that I couldn't pass up, the Chinese Geologic Survey. And they want to come out next month and meet with Rick about cooperative stuff. I said, look, we do Utah.
Tell them to bring money.
Yeah. No, they're offering me money. I said, well, if you do this with the survey, you'll have to double that. I mean, truly. You're going to have to double that. Double that number. Rick might be willing to talk to you. Not letting me out. not with what they're offering. It's like, sorry, guys.
Well, what's the? How do we get over there? What's the
you
call?
Just walk over.
Oh, we can walk.
Yeah,
cool.
Right, okay. Literally right across the street. Yeah.
I figured that was easy. So who's interested in coming? Have we got everyone or some? But, you know,
sure.
Hey, if you go, I'll shout Jim's.
I have a meeting at noon. Back in my old house.
Yeah, I don't think I told you. Yeah, they